Experts claim there is nothing tougher than a diamond. But at Diamonds Direct, we beg to differ. Have you ever met a mother? Strong, radiant, timeless. This Mother's Day, give her the gift that meets her match. With diamond jewelry starting at $200, plus Diamonds Direct's exceptional quality and unbeatable everyday price, you're sure to give her a gift that wows this generation and the next to come. Experience the thrill of jewelry shopping done right at Diamonds Direct. Diamonds Direct. Your love, our passion.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers? The Home Depot has an idea. Let Mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens. Right now, get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Shop our wide selection online and pick up your order in-store and give Mom the gift of a beautiful garden. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97 at the Home Depot. How doers get more done.
This is your moment, your time to shine, your comeback. You're ready for the next step in your career, and you want an education employers respect. So you're not just going back to school. You're coming back with Purdue Global. Backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected public universities, Purdue Global is built for people who bring their life experience into the online classroom. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Hi, hello, and welcome. This is Let's Talk About Myths, Baby, and I am your host and raging angry feminist who somehow gives fewer fucks than ever before, Liv. Everything in the world is awful. We're all just watching babies die from our phones while our countries fund the killing. I've spent months and months, like, wishing I could say how horrified I am about what is happening in Palestine into this microphone, but somehow I have to fear that my saying that innocent people, mostly children, shouldn't be killed because of the actions of one group, will lead some wild people in the world to tell me that this means, this not wanting children to die, means that I must hate an entire ethnic and religious group of people, rather than what the actual truth of my saying those words is, which is that I hate and blame the one very specific country that is bombing hospitals and sniping children. And I mean also the ones funding it, including my own country. The world is we're doing fine. Utterly wild that the mass murder of innocent people is somehow not something that we can, like, all agree is bad, actually. Like, do you remember when the U.S. punished an entire country with war after one group of people attacked them? Like, that was bad too, actually. Like, war is bad, actually. And punishing innocent people for the actions of other people that they have literally no control over is bad, actually. Like, no matter what the situation is, like, that's bad. Anyway, here we are. What a way to start the episode, right? Me? I just don't know how anyone is, like, just behaving like business as usual, you know? Like, I just can't, there's a disconnect in this world that we aren't just, like, all talking about this and all on the right side, you know, the side that, like, doesn't want more death of innocent people. Like, any innocent people, you know, no more death. It's just like that capitalism and Western supremacy are diseased cults that we're all just forced to live in. And on that light note, let's talk about the before times, when maybe actually they let women run shit. Yeah, that's what today's episode is about. Or rather, theorizing on it, at least. So it is now March, which means that not only do we have a month's worth of episodes featuring powerful and interesting and complex women, but I also get a theme to work off of and thus make my crumbling life just slightly easier. Thanks, International Women's History Month. And so for the past week, I've been either editing past episodes, like the one from Friday about winter harvest and the wrath of Demeter, and the one coming this Friday about a queer reading of Cersei's badass witchery, or I've been recording new ones, like an upcoming chat about the worship of Artemis and goddess worship generally, and another about women's sexuality in ancient Greece, and like the thread of it all. These episodes all ended up working together in ways that I wasn't really expecting, and I'm really excited to hear what you all think of them. But they've also inspired me when it comes to this narrative episode very specifically. Because in many of these conversations that are coming up, we've talked about the ways in which many of the goddesses are intentionally subjugated by the gods, in similar ways to the way real women were subjugated by real men. It's always been something that I've been interested in, obviously, like this specific treatment of these goddesses. But the chats that I have recently recorded and edited have given me some fascinating new ideas to explore, some specific examples of what exactly might have been happening in both the mythology and the culture itself. Today, we are going to look at some of those ideas. Goddesses who once reigned supreme, who proved they didn't need men for anything, and the resulting actions of the men when they felt those threats too acutely. Plus, the parthenogenic stingray. But before that, I want to tell you about another series that is coming up next month on the show. In past years, I've done those deep dives into the so-called myth and history of Atlantis and the skewed and fractured story of ancient Sparta. And now we are diving into the Bronze Age and its so-called collapse. The Bronze Age is one of the most interesting time periods of the ancient world for countless reasons. Egypt was thriving, Mesopotamia was popping off, and Greece was giving Homeric bards the inspiration for the Iliad and the Odyssey. And then something happened. The loud history bros on YouTube or Instagram or TikTok will tell you that, like, out of the blue, entire civilizations collapsed around the Mediterranean and just disappeared. That to this day, it remains an utter mystery what happened to the Mycenaeans. Just gone without a trace. They'll tell you that Greece descended into a dark age where they lost the ability to read the written word. That from the dark and dreary period of nothingness, Homer sprung fully formed like Athena from Zeus's head. What actually happened is, like, obviously far more complicated, considerably less mysterious and alien, but far, far more interesting. Mostly because, well, like, it's the truth and not pseudo-historical nonsense. So that's what's coming out in April. Until then, a month of episodes about the women who came during, after, and in some cases, maybe even before the Bronze Age. Like today. Today, I want to talk about the concept of a prehistoric goddess who reigned supreme in what would later become ancient Greece. This is episode 251, Parthenogenesis, Prehistoric Goddesses, and the Threat of an Independent Woman. There's a stingray in an aquarium in the States that's become pregnant all by herself. The scientific word for this type of pregnancy, that is, one that happens without the involvement of a male, is called parthenogenesis. A literal translation of the word into English today would be virgin birth. Parthenos is ancient Greek for virgin but unmarried woman. It's often referred to just as virgin. There are probably some philologists who might take issue with unmarried woman, and that's, like, fair, I guess. But my point in this case is to make clear that the modern connotation of virgin isn't what they would have considered in the ancient world, or at least this part of the ancient world. Today, at least in English and in the Western world, we think of the word virgin in this more, much more, Christianized context. Some kind of, like, physicality involved, bleh, and the explicit idea that the person has just, like, never had sex. But especially when it comes to the term parthenogenesis, it doesn't remotely matter whether the woman has ever had sex before. It's simply the matter of there being no man involved in the conception. It's important and empowering to have that additional context, to consider the term without the implication of Christianized purity, right? Because that simply isn't the point. She doesn't have to be pure. She just didn't have fucking sperm in there to help make the baby. The word parthenogenesis might sound familiar, too, and not just because, you know, I put it in the title of this episode. I have told you about parthenogenesis before. There are a number of goddesses in Greek myth who have children this way, without a man. Gaia is the most obvious. Mother Earth gave birth to most of the physical world as we know it, without the involvement of a man. Nyx, too, the goddess of night, had, like, this whole slew of kids without a god to help her. And then, of course, Hera, who gave birth to Hephaestus without the help of Zeus. There's a very big difference in terms of the story and its implications as we go through the generations, between Gaia down to Hera. And oh, are we going to talk about it all? Because, well, if you look at the Theogony, both the work of Hesiod, which I have shared with you all in intense detail over the years, and all of which you can listen to in a reading episode, and the concept of the Theogony itself, the genealogical history of the Greek gods. I've been looking at the Theogony lately with a new set of eyes, I guess. That's a very weird way of phrasing it. But essentially, what I'm going to present to you all today is that there is a way in which you can read the Theogony and almost watch as the world changed from one where women reigned supreme to one where men were threatened enough by this, by women's abilities, that they just took over, making the power of the women around them smaller and smaller, generation by generation, until it became almost forgotten. The world just forgot that they ever reigned at all. In the beginning, there was Gaia, Mother Earth, the creator of everything. She didn't do it with the help of a man. She created the physical world by herself. Quote, she brought forth long hills, graceful haunts of the goddess nymphs who dwell amongst the glens of the hills. She bore also the fruitless deep with his raging swell, Pontus, without sweet union of love. Without the sweet union of love, it's a very funny way of saying sex, but it's Hesiod, after all. Fortunately, this isn't about Hesiod as any kind of person. It is simply about what exists within the Theogony. And so the point remains, Gaia did all of this. She created the earth and the beauty of nature, all of it, without a man. This is one of the very first stories, not only of parthenogenesis, but of, like, creation itself, at least from the ancient Greek world. And it was this woman creating and bearing children without ever even considering the involvement of a man. But of course, though the story itself was likely much, much older, you know, this work created and then written down by men. So before we even hear of Gaia creating all of that without the help of a man, we are told that, you know, she did create one. Quote, and earth first bore starry heaven, equal to herself, to cover her on every side, and to be an ever sure abiding place for the blessed gods. Heaven, Uranus, you know, sounds awfully nice, actually. For now, at least. We'll get back to Uranus. For now, let's look at Nyx, Night. Her children were, you know, perhaps a little less joyful, but numerous. Quote, and Night bore hateful doom and black fate and death, and she bore sleep and the tribe of dreams, and again the goddess murky night, though she lay with none, bore blame and painful woe, and the Hesperides, who guard the rich golden apples and the trees bearing fruit beyond glorious ocean. And then, of course, we have the only Olympian child born of parthenogenesis, the son of Hera, Hephaestus. Quote, But Hera, without union with Zeus, for she was very angry and quarreled with her mate, bore famous Hephaestus, who is skilled in crafts more than all the sons of heaven. Now, on its face, these are three interesting examples of parthenogenesis and goddesses during the earliest days of the Greek mythological cosmos. But I'm interested in where these ideas might have come from and how they might have been manipulated. Before we look a little closer at what's happening here, or rather what I theorize might be happening here, let's talk about the prehistoric mother goddess. Here's the thing about anything prehistoric. There's a reason it's called that. It's because we don't have written records of the time period. It's literally prehistory. It means we don't know for certain what's going on. Obviously, time period-wise, there are lots of other names for, like, Neolithic, Paleolithic, all of that. I'm not going to pretend that I'm good enough at that. My point is what we're talking about now does not have written record to explain what's happening. But it does mean we can still make some educated guesses. Before I tell you about the prehistoric mother goddess, though, let's look at some things from the Bronze Age that support the existence of her. On the island of Crete, and on many of the Cycladic islands, there are many, many examples of figurines, which have often been called simply the goddess figurines. In the case of the Cycladic figurines, they are iconic as fuck. There have been so many of them found across the islands that, and they've come to symbolize the islands in many ways. They're on flags, logos, they fill the museums. The quintessential Cycladic mother goddess figurine, at least in my mind, are the pieces which depict this, like, vaguely human form. They have, like, really big heads, and their arms are often, like, crossed below their chests, and then they have these cute little boobs. They're adorable. They're not always called goddess figurines, and their gender isn't even always assumed to be women. But frankly, I refuse to believe that they are anything but goddess figurines. Does this mean that they were meant to represent a particular goddess? I mean, probably not, maybe. But I think to deny that these pieces depict some kind of worship of the divine feminine is, frankly, bullshit. I mean, the volume of them. Shifting to Crete, there's a whole other tradition of goddess figurine. The unnamed goddesses of Crete are often very different from those of the Cyclades, but no less powerful and prehistoric. I mean, actually, these are just all from the Bronze Age. The most famous goddess of Crete is the snake goddess. She's a woman wearing a traditional Minoan dress with the big flowing and tiered skirt and the exposed breasts, similar to what was painted onto the walls of the palace at Knossos. The remnants of which survive. You can Google these images. They're incredible. She's often got a cool little headpiece. And, well, she's got snakes. Sometimes she's holding the snakes up in the air. Sometimes they're wrapped around her arms or her in some way. But there are almost always snakes. Needless to say, the Minoan snake goddess is fucking awesome. Sometimes you might see her with the name Ariadne, but as far as I understand it, that's like a later invention. This desire to attribute this famed and prehistoric figurine with a goddess of the later mythology. And here's where I diverge from the way I usually write these episodes. With, you know, heavy amounts of research and context and detail. Because, well, like, today I want to theorize. So, you know, grain of salt here, whatever I'm saying, because most of what I want to talk about now is my own ideas. Obviously, I like to think I have a pretty decent grounding in the mythology and the history, but still, this is all me. So, you know, don't go using it as a source for anything important. Because, well, like, no one can agree on who these figurines were meant to represent, where the inspiration for them came from, or what purpose they served. It's interesting to read, like, about the varied theories on them. A little dive into the Wikipedia page for the Minoan snake goddess gives you, like, a whole host of suggestions to work off of. She's coming from a tradition originating in Syria, or Phoenicia. She's a precursor to a goddess of animals. She's a fertility goddess, or she represents domesticity in some way. I think you might guess how I feel about that one, but not to say that she, you know, couldn't or shouldn't be a fertility goddess, but there's this old tradition the past few hundred years of men claiming basically anything to do with women must be about fertility. Or in the case of the claim that I read, you know, because her tits are out, she must represent fertility. Like, she couldn't just, like, have her tits out because They're just like a part of the body like anything else. Not to mention, we have existing wall paintings showing that maybe the Minoan women just, like, had their tits out, because why shouldn't they? And if there's, like, 10 women dressed like that, like, why would the goddess be a fertility goddess anyway? I digress. Because the sources mentioned on the Wikipedia page, they made me grumble. The point, really, is that no one knows for sure, and that's not entirely because of the prehistory of it all. Many of these figurines, you know, are from the Bronze Age, when there was writing that we can decipher now. It's just that the writing that we have wasn't interested in telling humans of, like, 3,500 to 4,000 years later what their figurines were meant to represent. Weird, I know. This is the case for the Minoan figurines more than the Cycladic, because the latter are sometimes more like 4,500 or 5,000 years old, like well before Linear B. As far as I know, they're some of the oldest finds in all of Greece. They're fucking cool. All of this is to say that while it hasn't and probably will never be confirmed, the existence of so many figurines, which can be reasonably seen as women or goddesses, suggest something important about the beliefs that came before. For all my talk of these being primarily my own speculations, though, I am going to first read you a little something from Sarah Pomeroy's book, Goddesses, Whores, Wives, and Slaves. It's such a good title. Women in Antiquity is a subtitle. Makes more sense. Quote, mother goddesses were prominent in the Bronze Age cults of Minoan Crete. Numerous statuettes from the Bronze Age and earlier periods that may represent the mother goddess and their worshippers or priestesses have been found. Pomeroy later writes, quote, it has been thought that fertility goddesses were worshipped in Crete as well as by an autochthonous matriarchal population on the mainland of pre-Bronze Age Greece. Greek-speaking invaders brought with them the worship of Zeus, with its emphasis on male dominance and patriarchal law. The invaders, to consolidate their conquests, married their gods to the native goddesses. Pomeroy's really helping me with my theorizing, honestly. It was great, because I had all these ideas and then found that quote. See, I want to explore the idea that these are goddess figurines and that the unnamed goddesses that they represent are, in fact, this prehistoric mother goddess, or many prehistoric goddesses. And since I had already intended on breaking down the written sources alongside the idea that these goddesses came first and Greek myth came second, having the quote about the introduction of Zeus worship is deeply helpful. I'm certain that the ideas that I want to explore here, by the way, like, I'm sure that they have been explored in academic writings. I am not suggesting I am the first to say this. It's just that, like, I don't have a lot of access to that. And today, I feel like just talking about what I think. The conversations I recorded last week, and which will be coming out later this month, and the Demeter conversation last Friday inspired these ideas that I can't quite let go of. I want to look at how Hesiod's Theogony could, in its own way, show how the Greek world might have transitioned from a matriarchal society that worshipped this prehistoric mother goddess to the patriarchal society that we know so well, the one that worshipped the Olympians, and namely, Zeus.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Like many of us, you might think identity theft will never happen to you. But consider this. There's a new identity theft victim every 3 seconds in the U.S. That's over 15 million people by the end of this year, equal to the populations of New York, Los Angeles, and Chicago combined. Even worse, identity theft victims often don't even know they're victims. That's why LifeLock Identity Theft Protection alerts you to identity threats, even the ones that don't show up on a credit report, like data breaches, fraudulent bank transactions, loan and credit card applications, and crimes committed in your name. If your identity is stolen, your own dedicated LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will work to fix it. LifeLock protects you in ways that you simply can't on your own. Join now and save up to 25% your first year at LifeLock.com/iHeart. That's LifeLock.com/iHeart to save up to 25%. Identity theft protection starts here.
The Home Depot wants every mom to have their own outdoor oasis this Mother's Day. Whether that be a new space to relax or a beautiful garden upgrade, at The Home Depot, you could give mom a gift that's as unique as she is, with a stylish and comfortable place to entertain or relax for the mom who does it all. And with convenient delivery, you won't have to stress over getting it to her either. Looking to step up your Mother's Day flowers for the mom who's great with gardening? Let mom's green thumb do some digging with colorful flowers, pots, and premium soils to bring out the most in her patios, walkways, and gardens with the Home Depot's Mother's Day Savings Event happening now. Get Vigoro Potting Soil, just $8.97, for strong, healthy, vibrant plants indoors and outside. Start your Mother's Day shopping and saving today by checking out the Home Depot's extensive selection online at homedepot.com or directly in-store near you with convenient pickup and delivery options. See homedepot.com/delivery for details. The Home Depot, how doers get more done.
Picasso knows your vacation home is your best home. It's the place that brings family and friends together. It's where you're the best version of yourself. Picasso makes it easy to co-own a luxury vacation home in amazing locations. Listings start at $200,000 for 1/8 ownership. Picasso does the hard parts for you. Luxury furnishings, maintenance, billing, scheduling, and more, with a home management team that provides support before, during, and after your stay, so you can focus on the relaxing, hosting, and making memories with family and friends. And you can resell on Picasso's marketplace anytime, historically for a 10% gain. With Picasso, you can stop saying someday and start building family traditions today in a vacation home you own and revisit time after time. Visit Picasso.com today to see thousands of luxury vacation home listings. That's PACASO.com.
I've always been fascinated by the idea of this prehistoric mother goddess, a period of time when the people of the region worshipped women over men, where women ran things, or honestly more likely, like where everyone ran things together, and women just weren't seen as less than men. When I was doing my BA, like far too many years ago now, I wrote a paper on the goddess figurines of the Cycladic Islands for an archaeology class. It's one of the only papers I really remember writing because I was so utterly consumed by this idea of hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of these goddess figurines that have been found from this fully prehistoric time period, and which provide us with pretty fucking good evidence that there was a time when goddesses were worshipped more prominently than gods. It's no coincidence that these figurines come from this time before the written records that tell us of Zeus and all of his godly relations. So what if this is true? What if it's true that the people of the region over 1,000 years before the theogony ever existed to tell us about the gods of Olympus and their genealogy, what if those people worshipped a supreme mother goddess and goddesses just more generally? If that's true, then is it something that we can see evidence of in the theogony? Because the more I had those conversations, the more I thought about what the story of the theogony really is, the more I realized that I can see this in the text happening just before our eyes. So once more, let's return to those bits of the theogony that I talked about earlier. The world begins with Gaia. Chaos, maybe, sometimes gets to be the first being, but chaos is very clearly not something tangible, or even a god, to be worshipped. Really, it's Gaia, Mother Earth, this literal mother goddess of the natural world. And without any involvement from a male, Gaia creates this natural world. She is the earth, and the mountains, and the rivers, and forests, and plains, and plants, and animals. They are her children. These she gives birth to parthenogenically. Her body creates them without any male intervention, just like Charlotte the Stingray. But then, what happens to Gaia? She creates a man. She creates a husband, and as the story continues, that husband, Uranos, becomes threatened by her ability to create life when he cannot. And his response to feeling like his power is being threatened is to not only literally cover over Gaia's body completely, but he begins to subjugate her in very meaningful ways. Uranos doesn't like all of the children that they have together. Again, like, he's threatened by the control that Gaia has in creating life. He sees her ability as a threat, and the children she creates as, in certain cases, horrible monsters. Namely, the Hecatoncheires and the Cyclops. He's so horrified by them that he traps Gaia's children inside the Earth. Inside Gaia herself. Quote, "For of all the children that were born of Gaia and Uranos, these were the most terrible, and they were hated by their own father from the first, and he used to hide them all away in a secret place of Gaia, so soon as each was born, and would not suffer them to come up into the light, and Uranos rejoiced in his evil doing." He's taken Gaia's supreme power, her status as the Earth itself, and he's turned it against her. And then what happens? Gaia turns to her son, Cronos, for help. We're told that poor Gaia is straining and groaning with her children trapped inside her. So she makes his plan with Cronos to overthrow his father. It will happen at night, which is described like this. Quote, "And Uranos came, bringing on night and longing for love. And he lay about Gaia, spreading himself full upon her." It screams subjugation. Don't you think? Like, by nature of being the god of the sky, he gets to basically surround her completely. And that's ignoring what we can read into the idea of a husband whose wife is explicitly angry with him, covering her with his whole body and, quote, longing for love. Of course, we all know what happens next. Gaia trusts Cronos to help her, and he does defeat Uranos, castrates his father, and basically renders him harmless to Gaia. But he also renders him harmless to Cronos, and Cronos takes over the role his father took from Gaia. He rules over the world. He rules over Gaia. And of course, Cronos didn't even bother to free those children. And so with Gaia still under a man's thumb, another Mother Earth-type goddess emerges. She kind of takes this role. Her daughter, Rhea, wife to Cronos. And gods, we know how that goes. Cronos was just as threatened by women as his father, just as threatened by the female ability to create life, that he does exactly as his father did before him. He subjugates his wife through the imprisonment of her children. One by one, Cronos swallows the children birthed by Rhea. And again, Rhea trusts her son, Zeus, to stop his father. I won't tell you that story again. Like, we know that Zeus manages it. Of course, there's no question that with Cronos gone and the women that he and Uranos before him subjugated would not be given their agency back. Like, Rhea isn't so explicitly subjugated, but she isn't celebrated either. And instead, the next woman in this long line of those subjugated by their husbands is actually not Hera yet, but she's coming. Instead, it's Zeus's first wife, Metis. Here's how Hesiod describes Zeus's relationship with the Titan goddess of wise counsel, Metis. Quote, "Now Zeus, king of the gods, made Metis his first wife, and she was wisest among gods and mortal men. But when she was about to bring forth the goddess bright-eyed Athena, Zeus craftily deceived her with cunning words and put her in his own belly. Later, Athena's birth is described, you know, the way she burst from Zeus's head, fully grown. But we're interested in her conception. Zeus's first wife, Metis, probably better understood as his first, like, lover, you know, which in this case is just kind of interchangeable with wife. She was herself swallowed because of the threat that her fertility posed to him. What we learn elsewhere in Hesiod is that Zeus was told that Metis would bear a child more powerful than him, so he just ate her. He literally ingested the woman whose fertility, whose ability to create life, posed a threat. And then he gave birth to Athena himself, explicitly co-opting the role of a woman in order to ensure that he maintained complete control. And the most horrifying part of this is that if you go looking for who Athena's parents are, like, there are countless books and websites and everything that will tell you that Zeus bore her without the inclusion of a woman. Like, that Athena, like Gaia's children, was a child of parthenogenesis. When in fact, there doesn't appear to be a single ancient source that says this. Like, some don't mention Metis, but that tends to be because they don't retell the whole story, just the birth, so there's no need. But none of the ancient sources that I've found, even with the help of crowdsourcing this question, suggest that Zeus actually conceived Athena parthenogenically. Meanwhile, Wikipedia says it multiple times without crediting an ancient source, and even Britannica.com makes this claim without explaining where it came from. It's everywhere. This idea that he had the genetic ability to create life without a female, even though even the most patriarchal of Greek myth sources don't actually say that that's the case. But Zeus's status as Athena's only parent, because he certainly is that since he ingested Metis and never let her free, is later served as another means of subjugating a woman, his most famous wife, his sister Hera. What Zeus does to keep Hera in check, like controlled by her husband, is much more human than the gods who came before him. He just puts her in her place, like constantly, right? He makes her jealous intentionally. He spreads his like nasty godly seed all over town without ever considering her whatsoever. And he brags about having given birth to a child without not only Hera, but any woman at all. See, even Zeus intentionally ignores the role that Metis played in Athena's conception. And this is what leads Hera to become our next goddess who creates a child parthenogenically, without any intervention by a man. And the goddess Hephaestus. And as we all know, Hera finds Hephaestus to be imperfect because he has an issue with his foot, and she casts him from Mount Olympus. Obviously, this makes Hera look bad, and really most of Hera's actions in reaction to Zeus make her look bad. But that's important in itself. Basically, what I want to draw your attention to is the way that these three mother goddesses, because they are not only mother goddesses, but fertility goddesses, are slowly being subjugated by the men. Of course, Metis is part of it, but she fits the mother goddess role a little bit less, but certainly is perfect evidence for the same general argument. As the generations proceed down the line of the theogony, the women become less and less powerful, particularly in relation to the men. They become more petty, they become more stereotypically jealous and angry, just as the men become more righteous and powerful. Through the theogony of Hesiod, in my reading at least, you can essentially watch this transition from a matriarchal society that worshipped a supreme mother goddess, you know, all the way down the line, until you reach the period when this work was likely recorded, the early archaic period. And you can watch the progression of a new patriarchy and the regression of the old matriarchy. it feels like it could almost be a chart, you know, like depicting the fall of women and the rise of men. And to be clear, I am not saying that this was done intentionally. Like, I think this Hesiodic tradition, of course, it is oral storytelling, right? It is a story that was being told over hundreds and hundreds of years and was changing and adapting and flowing. And I think it became this way. It is a memory, a human memory of what came before, unintentionally put into this new and defining thing. At the beginning, the goddesses are all powerful. They are the creators of everything and everyone. Then, slowly but surely, they are subjugated by the men they create, or are related to, until they are goddesses like Hera, who is often depicted as little more than this nagging, jealous wife. But even still, there are these little remnants of the time period, like leftover pieces, that remained. Like Hera being able to conceive Hephaestus without a man, even if he's nothing like the children that Gaia was able to conceive without the help of a man. And that's not a dig on Hephaestus, like he's incredible, but it is how the story goes. To Hera, he is a failure. Gaia is supreme until she is smothered by her husband, and her children are used against her. Rhea is powerful until her children are systematically stolen by their father, rendering her status as a mother goddess almost pointless. Like, what is a mother goddess when her children are being consumed by their father? Metis is this titan goddess of wisdom and intelligence until Zeus eats her and steals the birth of their daughter. It is no coincidence that not only is Athena regularly called just the daughter of Zeus alone, due to the fact that basically Zeus kills her mother, but that Athena is the man's goddess, the hero's goddess, her father's favorite, right? Like, Athena is the example of Zeus not only taking over the role of conception from the mother, but letting it influence how the daughter behaves. The goddess who was born because her father couldn't bear to let her mother be the powerful being that she naturally was, is the same goddess who becomes the most egregious agent of the patriarchy. And Hera, the third generation mother goddess, is just this stereotype of a jilted, jealous woman. There's so much more to be said of this, but God, this episode is long enough. I just had to look at this in detail because now that I've seen how this structure is visualized in the Theogony, like, I can't unsee it. To me, it feels so explicitly like this means of, probably unintentionally, rewriting the history that, you know, was only half remembered by the time of the Hesiodic tradition. This means of taking what existed in the history and corrupting it, turning this supreme mother goddess into these women who were less powerful deities, just stripping them of their power in the world in order to hand it over to the men. But hey, at least I get to be a woman like a few thousand years later, reading it and then seeing what they used to have. This power that they had before they were stripped of it by the men who were so threatened by the female ability to create life that they had to turn it into something that they controlled. Oh, nerds, that was so fun to write. Like, I am just utterly obsessed with this now. A large part of these ideas were inspired by a conversation that I had with my friend Kossi for the podcast. It's coming out at the end of the month. Among other wild and sexy things, Kossi and I talked about the threat that women posed in the ancient world when it comes to paternity. Something I'd never thought of, but the fear that men had that the children that their wife bore weren't actually theirs was, like, huge. And now I can see that it just, like, manifested in all of Greek myth. Like, I won't say too much about this, but goddesses, it's vital to this episode, so stay tuned for that. And just imagine, like, you're an Athenian man who's worried that his pregnant wife might not be having his baby. Like, where else would you look for reassurance than the mythology? Like, where countless women had children who weren't their husbands, like, but because they were children of the gods instead, it was fine. It feels like all of Zeus's escapades are like personifications of this fear over paternity. Fucking wild. Anyway, I've rambled long enough. Thank you so much for listening. And oh, goddess, there is so much more fascinating women-centric content to come this month. I want to talk about many niche goddess concepts and real-life women, like as many as possible. We are going to have a thrill of a fucking time. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is written and produced by me, Liv Albert. Michaela Smith is the Hermes to my Olympians, my assistant producer. Laura Smith is the production assistant and audio engineer. Select music used in this episode was by Luke Chaos. The podcast is part of the iHeart Podcast Network. Listen on Spotify or Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. Help me continue bringing you the world of Greek mythology and the ancient Mediterranean by becoming a patron, where you'll get bonus episodes and more. Mostly you just support me. The bonuses are, they're tough. They're few and far between, but there are like, I don't know, 50 to 100 you can go listen to in the back? Lots. Visit patreon.com/mythsbaby or click the link in this episode's description. I am Liv and I fucking love this shit. Like, particularly when I can talk about a supreme goddess who maybe waved snakes in the air while wearing a pretty swishy dress. Honestly, like, even though I'm scared as shit of real snakes, that it sounds pretty fucking awesome. It's just a pretty, pretty flowy dress you can spin in while your snakes fly in the air. Like, it's the dream.
If a new house is on your wish list in the next 5 years, grow your savings faster and experience your dreams with an Ohio Homebuyer Plus account from Kemba Financial Credit Union. A savings account specifically designed to save for a new home, where you can earn 7% APY, a $500 matching bonus, and a $1,500 mortgage closing cost credit. Learn more at Kemba.org. Offer expires March 31st, 2025. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. NMLS 292230. Equal housing lender. Federally insured by NCUA.
Live Nation presents Concert Week. Now through May 14th, get $25 tickets to over 5,000 shows. That's up to 75% off a summer full of your favorite artists like 21 Savage, Alanis Morissette, Cage the Elephant, Celeste Barber, Dierks Bentley, Fade, Hootie and the Blowfish, Janet Jackson, Kidz Bop Kids, Meghan Trainor, Bizzle Fuma, Sarah McLachlan. Get tickets to more than 5,000 summer shows for just $25. Until now through May 14th. Visit LiveNation.com/Concert Week to learn more and plan your summer with Sean Paul, Sum 41, 30 Seconds to Mars, oh, and Two Door Cinema Club.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
Are you looking for the perfect move-in ready home this spring season? Now's the time to buy at Fisher Homes. For a limited time only, enjoy below market interest rates starting at 5.375% APR, 6.139% APR. With these exclusive lower rates, you can save hundreds on a move-in ready home and start enjoying the benefits of home ownership even faster. Schedule your personal tour with one of our new home specialists at fisherhomes.com and make this spring the season you find your perfect home sweet home. Financing provided by Victory Mortgage, LLC, NMLS 461249, Equal Housing Lender.